I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. People are becoming increasingly aware of public health initiatives, thanks to organizations like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. But who are these men and women actually out there in the fields of Rwanda and Peru, making a difference in the lives of the poorest populations? Today we speak with one such pioneer, Paul Farmer, who since his early 20s has been committed to disease and poverty reduction. Paul is the co-founder of Partners in Health, which he started in Haiti in the mid-1980s.
I was in Rwanda, and we were rounding in the morning. By 10 o'clock in the morning, we'd seen a guy who was bitten by a cobra, and two boys who should have been in school but weren't in school because they were poor, who mistook a landmine for a toy and picked it up. It's just stunning to think about what would happen to these people if they didn't have access to health care as a right.
Coming up, Paul Farmer explains how he got Partners in Health off the ground from scratch. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Paul Farmer, the co-founder of Partners in Health, an organization that provides health care to the world's poorest communities. Paul has essentially created public health care systems in developing countries, providing free drugs to patients who have AIDS or multidrug-resistant tuberculosis. He spent his career trying to get policymakers and the general public to understand the link between poverty and disease, which he calls the twin epidemics. Welcome.
Thank you, Jessica, for having me.
Could you please describe what Partners in Health is?
Well, first of all, I think that was a great description, so thank you. Legally, and I feel self-conscious saying legally, it's a public charity. We're based in the United States in one sense, the headquarters here, but really what we do is build sister organizations wherever we work. And our biggest projects are in Haiti, and even though people know more perhaps about some of our work with tuberculosis or AIDS, as you just said, we're really interested in poverty reduction and in basic rights, not just the right to health care, which is hard enough, but the right to clean water, the right to primary education, and other basic entitlements. So I guess if I had to say what I think Partners in Health is, it would almost be some sort of human rights organization that focuses on the needs of families living in poverty. And of course, sickness is a huge part of that.
How did you come to the decision to devote your life to providing health care in developing countries? Where did that come from?
I made that decision in Haiti when I was 23 years old. And, of course, I had to get to Haiti, so I must have had reasons to do that. And the reasons I gave myself back when I was in college was that I had met Haitians in the migrant farm worker stream. So these are seasonal laborers who are, you know, pushed out of their country by poverty and political violence and end up in our country, in my country, doing menial labor, harvesting crops from Florida all the way to upstate New York. I just got very interested in what they were doing and the conditions under which they labored, and started having some conversations that I just, you know, still to this day, I feel like I'm having the same conversation. You know, why would you leave Haiti to come here and work under these conditions?
Now, how did you come into contact with them initially?
Well, initially, when I was a kid in Florida. So I'm not sure, you know, when you're a kid, you make these connections that may or may not prove salient later in life. But as a student in college, I really got interested.
And that you went to Duke?
I went to Duke.
With this interest in mind, what did you do after graduation?
When I graduated from Duke, I got this prize, which was for, of all things, it was about Haitian artists. And it was $1,000, and I thought, well, you know, I've read the books about Haiti. They say that the per capita income is about 300 and something. So I thought, oh, I could make that do for a year. And off I went.
How did you make your way ultimately to Conge, which was the place that Partners in Health really was born initially?
I made a contact in a town in central Haiti with a Haitian priest named Fritz Lafontaine. He was living in this town but doing mission work, and he was very focused on, again, these basic social rights, schools particularly. And I thought, well, if I go with him, maybe I could work on the healthcare part of it.
And from my understanding, Conge is one of the poorest parts of Haiti, which, I mean, Haiti itself is pretty poor, but Conge is even a multitude above that. Can you describe what it looked like when you were there
for the first time? Sure, I'll give it a try. It was a squatter settlement. I think that if you look at really for poverty in the poor world, the most difficult places are the urban slums and probably squatter settlements where landless peasants go. And peasant sounds like a strange word, although it's a word that the Haitians use to describe themselves. These people, who later founded Conge, had fled a hydroelectric dam project. And their valley, where they lived for many generations, was flooded. And so they just went up into the hills. And Conge was one of those small squatter settlements where people didn't own the land, and they were living in ramshackle huts. And so it was very, it looked like it just been thrown up hastily. That the houses were, you know, made out of twigs, and they had dirt floors, and it was a very dispirited place back then. And it looks very different now, but that's what it looked like in 1983 to me. Very dusty and dry also.
One sign of poverty is tin roofs that people have on their houses, but the Conge inhabitants didn't even have tin roofs. They didn't have that luxury. They had twig roofs.
That's right. They had thatch roofs, and they spoke a lot about this. You know, I had this association in my mind of tin roofs and poverty, and then I found out, well, there's something a lot worse than that. Dirt floors, really mud floors, because it rains there, you know, half the year or a good part of the year. So it was a real mess.
How emotionally tied were you to Conge after living among these people for a few months? Was it the type of feeling where you said, okay, I'm going to stick with them and then just go back to med school in Boston and go on with my life? Or was there some sort of visceral connection to these people?
Well, it felt visceral. It still feels visceral to me. Now that I you know, I work as much in Africa this past year, I've been in Rwanda. I've been in Rwanda a lot more than I was in Haiti this past year, but that's still home for me.
There's a book about you by Tracy Kidder called Mountains Beyond Mountains. And one of the sort of the visual takeaways I had was the U.S. government actually being complicit in this dam project. They might have had benign incentives, who knows, but the results were pure squalor. And these inhabitants just one day saw the water rising and had to take their most precious belongings and run into the mountains. And that gives you an example of the sort of urgency behind their homelessness.
Well, you know, the first time I heard them say that that's what happened, I thought they were taking poetic license. You know, I thought, well, surely they didn't leave the day the water rose. I mean, there's this giant buttress dam being built, you know, 10 kilometers away. Surely they knew what was coming. But when I heard the same story again and again, I realized they weren't exaggerating. They really didn't understand what was happening, and so they didn't have time to erect, you know, new houses or to move properly, and that's really what happened.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Paul Farmer, co-founder of Partners in Health, an organization that provides health care to the world's poorest populations. Paul started Partners in Health in Haiti in his 20s while he was still a Harvard Medical School student. Partners in Health operates in Haiti, Peru, Rwanda, and Russia. You spent a couple of years surveying the conditions of these people, going house to house, before building your first clinic in 1985. How did you go about building that first health clinic?
Well, first we had to look for money, and there was a connection, a church connection that the priest had, and all of us also sought money. And I was lucky because I met in Boston, when I came for my Harvard Medical School interview, I made a connection that later led me to meet Tom White, who is a Boston businessman, and he gave an anonymous donation to a charity in Boston, which he designated for Haiti. So some $5,000 came to us back in 1983, maybe early 1984, and we built a bread oven, which proved to be a mistake, by the way, talking about entrepreneurship. Wasn't a good idea. But anyway, it sounded good at the time. And then I came back to Harvard and wrote an essay about this experience. And he read the essay. The director of the charity to which he'd contributed sent him the magazine, and he read it, and he said, I'd like to meet this guy, Paul Farmer. And the first time I met him was in Port-au-Prince at the airport.
But I think you missed an interesting point, which is you said to the organization, if he wants to meet me, he has to come to Haiti.
That sounds kind of sassy now. He's been so generous.
So what gave you that moxie or that gall almost to say, okay, if this potential funder wants to meet me, he has to come to Haiti?
Yeah, I look back on that and think that was it proved to be a good strategy, but I think it was a little bit too much moxie, actually. But it worked out great because that's where we met, and we have been friends and coworkers ever since, actually. And I say coworkers, you know, some people would say, well, you were a medical student, and he was a Boston developer, you know, and so he's your funder. But actually, that's not the case. He was really one of the founders of Partners in Health and a funder.
What do you do to open up a healthcare clinic? You got the locals to help build a one-room building, or walk me through that.
So it was building a team locally. It was a lot of young people, Haitians, people about my age, and it was recruiting some medical staff in Haiti. It was keeping our supporters engaged and letting them know this was going to be a long-term project. And then it was designing this clinic, which I, in my view, we designed very poorly. And we really had to take it down and redo it because when we built it, we didn't think ahead about the flow and the traffic. You know, it should have been obvious that in a country that poor and that sick, where there are not other clinics available to really poor people, that we'd be overwhelmed. And so you really had to, we should have given more thought to how to lay it out. You know, we saw thousands of patients in the first year in 1985, maybe even tens of thousands. But last year, across our networks in Haiti, which is not just Conge now, but seven different towns, we had 1.2 million patient exchanges. So, and as you were kind enough to say, it's really a public health system. So, you know, that takes thought. We spent a lot of time trying to think, how will the patients move through the system? You know, and actually drawing arrows on pieces of paper and say that, you know, trying to plan their trajectory so it's not a mess, you know, not a traffic jam. And that's how it was in 1985. It was just a traffic jam. And so for years we grew and grew, and then in 1993 we put in a hospital facility right there in Conge.
Was there any problem with your credibility, or were these people so desperate they just came to the clinic because they had no other choice?
Well, we didn't have a big credibility problem early on. We really didn't. And part of it was due to the great need. The other part I would like to think was due to the fact that we really took our time to find out what people needed. We were actually going to their homes and saying, you know, what is it that you need? What are your problems? Some of it's so obvious, you know, if you're hungry, you need food. And if your children are unvaccinated, you need vaccines. And if you're injured, you need a physician who can stitch you up. Getting really rooted in that. In those communities, it's because it was always many communities. I think that was one of the reasons we had credibility.
And sometimes part of the cure is just having somebody to be able to talk to. The fact that you were able to listen to these people was medicinal in a way.
I'd like to think so, yeah. And, you know, speaking their language, that helps a lot.
There are stories of you walking for 4 hours on foot, going to one patient's home to make sure that he was taking his medication. Is that true?
That's true. Yeah, it's not true just of me. It's true. We try to inculcate that value in all of our doctors and nurses. And there's no tradition of that in the United States or in Haiti or in Rwanda or in Peru. And so pushing that as a model, saying, you know, we really need to do this, even if it doesn't seem like the best use of your time, getting to know, you know, the way people live and getting to know their families and seeing their problems firsthand in their homes, in their communities, is a good thing. We've stuck with that over the years.
When you're walking, did you ever think, like, what am I doing?
Yeah, I still think that. You know, I still think, is this really going to work? Is this, you know, can we really pull this off?
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Paul Farmer, co-founder of Partners in Health. We'll hear more from Paul coming up. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Paul Farmer, the co-founder of Partners in Health, an organization that provides health care to the world's poorest communities. Paul has essentially created public health care systems in developing countries, providing free drugs to patients who have AIDS or multidrug-resistant tuberculosis. He spent his career trying to get policymakers and the general public to understand the link between poverty and disease, which he calls the twin epidemics. Just to give one a sense of how destitute these people were that you were serving, Tracy Kidder, there's a quote in his book where a 13-year-old comes to you. She needed a spinal tap, you determined, and she was screaming, crying. She said, "It hurts. I'm hungry." And you said, "Can you believe it? Only in Haiti would a child cry out that she's hungry during a spinal tap." Do you remember that?
I do. I'm glad he wrote that down because otherwise I probably would have forgotten it, but it was incredibly vivid. But then I get stunned like that every week that I'm, in these places. And I was in Rwanda in March, and we were rounding in the morning. And, now I'm sort of, I'm the grandfather. I'm the oldest guy around there. I'm 46, but, I've been at this a long time. But by 10 o'clock in the morning, we'd see a guy who was bitten by a cobra and two boys who should have been in school but weren't in school because they were poor, who mistook a landmine for a toy and picked it up. It's just stunning to think about what would happen to these people if they didn't have access to health care as a right, as something other than a commodity to buy. I think a lot of people are more aware of what's happening, say, in Africa or even Haiti and the poorer parts of the world, and how these diseases are not dissociable from poverty.
I think one of your Haitian patients said it best, which was giving people medicine for tuberculosis and not giving them food is like washing your hands and drying them in dirt.
I heard that several times from several patients. It would be so much easier if we could say, okay, we're gonna make sure patients with AIDS get antiretrovirals or that women get modern obstetric care. But it's just the beginning. And it's hard enough to do the medical work, the public health work. But then you have to think about, water and housing and land rights, land tenure and seed prices and fertilizer prices and fair markets and debt relief, and just goes on and on. And, but that's what we do.
I'm curious about your personal life during those years when you were so focused on your medical education, but also building this organization in Haiti. Did you ever feel like I'm missing out on, a larger social life or missing things at home? Or were you so steadfast that didn't even come up?
Well, I it's hard to, do this work and to travel so much, but I feel that other people are missing out on social life. They're the ones missing out. This is what social life, the social world is like. It's a world of rich and poor, of people dying of malaria when there are treatments right nearby, of millions of people with AIDS and tuberculosis, who don't ever get the drugs. That's what social life is to me, I've got to say. I don't say that in a defensive way. People should do what they want, but I think the work that we're doing gives us great meaning in our lives. I'm very proud of my daughter, who's not even 9, but she, raises money for the pediatric pavilion in Rwanda, and she likes working there and being there. Her interest in this work is genuine.
Today you're wearing a really nice suit. In the book that Tracy Kidder wrote, he said that when you went out to start raising money, you had one suit, and it was a black suit. And you really liked that suit because you could write prescriptions and, wipe the ink on your suit and travel then to Russia for 10 hours, and the suit still looked like it was in top shape when you got there.
It's an indestructible suit.
And, by the way, your wallet was a plastic bag. Where does this frugality of yours come from?
Oh, I'm not frugal, Jessica. You get focused on this work, and other things somehow seem less important. You're around people who are dying for just lack of food, and my response is not to say, well, I should not have food. And I hope I've never been sanctimonious like that or scrupulous, but it does put creature comforts out of one's mind sometimes. But I don't think I'm frugal in that way.
But you did have a kind of a frugal upbringing. And you were born in North Adams, Massachusetts, in the Berkshires, and your family moved to Alabama. And you spent most of your earlier life in Alabama and Florida.
That's right.
You lived in a bus. How did you go about living in a bus?
Well, I had no say in the matter since I was about 9. but we lived in, it's the funny thing about it is it was actually a bus that had been used to screen people for tuberculosis. My father just built all these bunks inside, and we lived in it. And, you get used to anything as a kid.
There was a story that one day you went to school in a car.
The staff car.
The staff car, and you said, Dad, please don't drop me off in front of school. I'm embarrassed.
I didn't say that. It wasn't just me. It was all 6 of us.
There were 6 siblings. And your dad pulled up to the front of the school. Well, you tell the story.
My father did not cotton to pretense, and he had these ridiculous cars. He bought this car from the government. You know, the government sells off its surplus, and you can bid. It's called a sealed bid, and you bid on it. And my father bid $288 for that car, remember? It had said U.S. property of the U.S. Army on the side, and he just took a spray paint can and spray painted it. And, of course, we were mortified that he would drop us off, you know, near the school in that car. And when someone, I don't know, maybe it was me, but I don't think it was me. Someone made the mistake of saying, don't drop us off near the school. And he actually drove into the bus lane where it says buses only and honking the horn and said, that'll teach you.
Did you think your dad was strange at all?
No, I didn't.
Up?
I mean, no, I didn't think he was strange. He was obviously different from other people's fathers. You know, I didn't know anyone else who lived in a bus. But strange, no. I thought he was really smart and remarkable and interesting. And you know, he taught us all a lot. And so, no, I'm very grateful to him.
Also, you're quite precocious, and there's a great story about you. When you were 11 years old, you read the Lord of the Rings trilogy, and you went to the library and said, can you please give me something else like this? And they gave you other, you know, mystery and adventure books, and you came back, you said, no, this is not what I'm looking for. And at 11 years old, you were given War and Peace, and you came back and you said, this is just like Lord of the Rings.
Well, it is. You have to admit.
How does an 11-year-old know that, though?
I don't know. I'm very lucky that I had that love of reading, which a lot of my siblings had. You know, we were stuck in the bus or the boat, and not a lot to do. And my parents, I mean, they didn't really like us to go far away, and so we all read a lot.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Paul Farmer, the co-founder of Partners in Health, an organization that strives to alleviate disease and poverty among the world's poorest populations. Paul got Partners in Health off the ground while he was a student at Harvard Medical School in the 1980s. Going back to Partners in Health, how did you go from a one-off clinic in Haiti to now an international organization with a presence in places like Mexico and Rwanda and even Boston, Massachusetts?
Well, it grew sort of organically for a long time. We went from Haiti to Peru, for example. I said organically. What does that mean? Well, we started in 1988, I think, a very good tuberculosis control program in Haiti, which is focused on community health workers, making sure they could visit the patients. Because although many of us doctors are honored to make four-hour treks to see patients, you can't run a program that way. You have to get lots of people doing that. And when we developed this expertise, we found ourselves in the middle of a major epidemic of drug-resistant tuberculosis in Peru. We had personal connections to Peru. We'd promised that we'd work there. And then that dragged us to Siberia, where we found out there was an even more troubling epidemic of drug-resistant tuberculosis there, largely in the prisons. And the way we got to Boston was we started having these very good outcomes with tuberculosis and later AIDS. And, you know, you work in a Harvard teaching hospital and someone rolls in the door to the emergency room, they're sick because they're not really taking their medicines for AIDS or tuberculosis. And they weren't doing well. And so we started asking questions, why aren't they doing well right here in the shadows of, you know, Boston's biggest teaching hospital? The answer was, again, social problems. They were different social problems. And, hey, they weren't, you know, hunger, but they may have been domestic violence, housing instability, don't speak English as a first language, you know, insurance problems, addiction to drugs or alcohol. So we took the same model from Haiti and brought it to Boston.
You talk about bringing a tuberculosis model to Russia, but there's another detail in there, which is you went to George Soros, the Open Society, and said, will you please fund our project in Peru? And they said, well, actually, our attention right now is in Russia. And you wrote a letter to George Soros and said, actually, I think you're going about it the wrong way. And you told him about this multi-drug resistant approach. And he invited you to his office the next day and decided to, or asked you to lead the project in Russia.
It's the basics of the story. That's right. So in essence, they said, no, we can't help you in Peru, but you can help us in Russia. But it's very compelling. You know, they were doing very good work and needed some tinkering on the clinical side. And just one figure, about a quarter of all people in the prison system with tuberculosis were dying when we started the project. And that's terrible. You know, it should be none. And 24% were dying. And when we introduced this new model in the prison system, the death rate went to zero in 1 year.
I want to go back to Haiti for a minute. When you were trying to get resources for your patients, you were going back and forth between Haiti and Harvard Medical School. I don't know how many Harvard Med students go to Haiti in their spare time and then come back and ace their exams. That was must have been a challenging time for you. You took some resources from Harvard Med School to help the clinic in Haiti. You know, for instance, a microscope ended up in a Haitian clinic and some drugs. In fact, I think it was $92,000 worth of drugs that ended up in Haiti.
Well, Tom White paid for those eventually.
And by the way, it's ironic because Harvard Med loved you and you're a tenured professor there now. But how did you get away with that stuff?
Well, you know, the ethics of, I should plead the fifth, you know, but the ethics of distributive justice are really what was on my mind, you know. You know, to go from Harvard to Haiti for years and years and years, to go to places where there's so many resources sort of stacked up in one area for medicine, you know, and to go, and you're there in 12 hours. You know, you're from the Brigham to the squatter settlement, it's about 12 hours.
And, 2 hours from Miami.
Even less. And a lot of that 12 hours, of course, is in vehicles, in jeeps or a car. To me, the big ethical question, let me leave aside my youthful peccadilloes, The chief ethical problem here is the ethics of poverty. You know, to claim, for example, that the United States is unrelated to Haiti is a nonsense. You know, the John Adams, in his History of the United States, said that we wouldn't even have the United States as it is today if not for Haiti because of the Louisiana Purchase, which wouldn't have happened unless the Haitian Revolution occurred. And, you know, and it goes on and on. That's the late, you know, 18th, early 19th century. And it just, the connections got even tighter and tighter. I mean, we occupied Haiti militarily for 20 years in the 20th century. And so, to me, once I'd been in Haiti for a year, it stopped seeming vivid and different and started seeming more connected to my country. And even, to put it more baldly, affluence in one place seemed much more connected to poverty in another than I ever knew. And that, to me, was the big ethical issue, is how can we move resources rapidly to those who need them. And, you know, that's how Haitians see things as well. And I think they're right. Was that a decent answer to your provocative question about the missing microscope?
I think the comment, it's better to ask for forgiveness than permission, is perfectly suited to this case of taking drugs from the medical school. And
well, you know, we did feel, too, and still feel to this day, that we'd like to permit institutions like Harvard to make a significant contribution to this work. But you can't do it just by creating experts. You have to move resources. And of course, universities and major teaching hospitals are not very nimble institutions. And it's not entirely popular, as you can imagine.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Paul Farmer, the co-founder of Partners in Health, an organization that strives to alleviate disease and poverty among the world's poorest populations. Paul got Partners in Health off the ground while he was a student at Harvard Medical School in the 1980s. So how much time are you spending out there talking to the public, talking to investors, and educating them rather than, you know, in the field in Conge, Haiti, for example?
Well, you know, I like the way you said investors, and I didn't a few years ago. But I finally understand that notion. Mm-hmm. When I see so much shoddy philanthropy and mediocre healthcare in the poor world, including that which is connected to people from the United States and Europe, they're also not doing a great job. You know, philanthropists are going to give away money, mm-hmm. and that's what they do. And I'd rather they give it to this kind of work. I could say us, but I'll just say this kind of work, which is very lean in terms of the money being spent in the first world and very lean on you know, spending a lot of money in management. And how much time am I doing that? A lot. 10 years ago, I would have just been kind of annoyed by having to do that sort of thing so much, but I'm not now. I really see it as the right thing to do.
We talk about how it might be easier for you now to raise money from investors because you've proven yourself, you've gotten results. But in the early days, who were your other allies aside from Tom White? Were there other sort of monetary breakthroughs that you had?
Yes, there were. First of all, I mentioned the support from churches. And it was very interesting to me, because it's not what I would have anticipated, that some of our most loyal support came from church groups. And we got a big break in the late 90s when the Gates Foundation was developed. The Gates Foundation really did CPR on international health. I mean, it really resuscitated a field that was almost moribund and very gloomy and hangdog and whiny. And people were always saying, well, we'll never have enough money to do this, we'll never do that, we have to scale down our projects, we have to make it very simple and very cost-effective, and all this jargon. Some of these projects, alas, are very complex, and they're not easily dealt with without substantial investments of time and energy and money. And until the Gates Foundation came along, I think things were looking fairly grim.
How much did they give Partners in Health?
Well, actually went to a consortium of groups through Harvard Medical School, to Partners in Health, to the Ministry of Health of Peru, to the World Health Organization, to the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, and to a group called the Task Force for Child Survival. But that coalition, and that was $44 million, huge grant.
And wasn't it, though, a last-minute coalition because you're all vying for support? And at the 11th hour, you decided, okay, well, if we're going to get this money, we need to cooperate.
Well, that's true. And, you know, Jim Kim was very involved, of course, in cobbling together this this coalition, and their senior medical advisor, Bill Foege.
You mentioned Jim Kim, who was your partner and co-founder of Partners in Health, and still is. It seems like he made you think big. Is that the case?
That's fair. Jim has always had this wonderful ability to think big.
In fact, before the Gates Foundation grant, I think you were going to ask for $2 to $4 million, and he said, well, why don't we ask for $45 million, just to give an example of his vision.
And, you know, that sounds arbitrary, but what I was saying was, why don't we ask for funding for the patients we plan to take care of in this one area of northern Lima? And he said, no, we should scale this up nationally. And so it wasn't about, you know, asking for 4 versus 40. It was really about two different projects. And Jim wanted not only to scale it up nationally, but also to try and, you know, export it to or replicate it in another site. And all that came to pass.
How large is Partners in Health now?
You know, we had a board meeting, Partners in Health board meeting, and someone in the senior staff at PIH did a head count. How many people work for Partners in Health? And it was 4,000 people. Only 60 of them in Boston, and the rest of them in the poor world where we're also concerned to create jobs. So, it was a small team 20 years ago, and all the people who labored so hard to get this off the ground are still working on this project.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Jessica, for having me.
My guest has been Paul Farmer, co-founder of Partners in Health. Coming up, we'll meet Israel Ganot, the co-founder of Gazelle, a company that resells used electronic equipment. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Israel Ganot, the co-founder of Gazelle, a company that resells used electronic equipment, including iPhones, BlackBerries, iPads, and recent Apple computers, among other items. The company was launched in 2006 and has recycled more than 1 million devices since inception. Prior to starting Gazelle, Israel worked as a research analyst at Goldman Sachs and a finance director at eBay and PayPal. Welcome.
Thank you, Jessica.
Could you please describe how Gazelle works? Let's say I have a BlackBerry Curve that I want to get off my hands.
What you'll do is go to our website, either on the desktop or on your mobile device, and look up the specific model that you want to sell. You'll answer a couple of simple questions about the condition of the item, and you get a price. And if you like the price, you'll give us your shipping address so we can send you packaging, and we'll pay for the shipping. As soon as you put the item in the mailbox and ship it to us, we'll receive it, inspect it, make sure that it's as described by you, and then send you the payment.
Now, you're a consumer-facing business, but it hasn't always worked this way. You initially tried partnering with businesses when you first launched. Can you describe that experience and some examples of that?
We've gone through quite an evolution. So in the early days, what we wanted to do is access consumers that buy product, and what a better place than go to Best Buy, go to Radio Shack, go to Amazon. eBay, where consumers buy a new product, and help those companies, those retailers, offer a trading service to their customer base. It just made a lot of sense. What the struggle was back then was that the economy was flourishing, the whole sustainability movement was just getting started, and frankly, this was not top on anybody's list.
And was there a catalyst or a specific event that really gave you the engine and the motivation to say, okay, we're going to change direction?
Yes, it's quite memorable. So we spent a lot of time with Best Buy. In April of 2007, we got a call in the evening basically saying that while they appreciate all the work that we've put into developing the program with them, they were going to pass. We were running out of cash. And again, we either had to close shop or change direction in a very aggressive way.
You also changed course at an auspicious moment. The economy was collapsing, which ironically was beneficial for the company. How come?
It was very beneficial to Gazelle because the biggest opportunity was to build awareness that all the stuff that's in your drawers, in your closets, that you know, the 5-year-old BlackBerry, the 3-year-old laptop that you're not using anymore has a value. It's collecting dust. So in the early days, it was really all about cash for your gadgets that you're not using, as opposed to where it is today, much more upgrading.
The number of devices that you accept is roughly less than 500. But back then, it was over, 200,000?
It was hundreds of thousands,
hundreds
including
of
movies
thousands.
And games and GPS systems was everything under the sun except for TVs.
And what percent of these devices do you actually are you able to resell versus that you're stuck with?
Everything has value. The only question is how much. From day one, everything that we acquired and paid value for, we are able to turn around and sell at a profit. So currently we resell 100% of the product, or if it's not 100%, it's 98%, 99%. The interesting thing about this business, which has always fascinated me, is that it's a supply-constrained business. Demand is insatiable.
You have spoken about the car trade-in business as an analogy to what you're doing. What parallels or similarities do you see, and what would you like to replicate?
Sure. So in the car business, 40 to 50% of all new car sales have a trade-in involved in it. So it's so consumer behavior around trade-in, to your point, is inherent in the way we buy new cars. That figure for consumer electronics is about 3%. Inertia is a very strong kind of human behavior, consumer behavior. When you buy the new, let's say, iPhone, you don't care a whole lot about the old device. It's sort of your ex at the time. So building awareness for the value of the devices and then convincing consumers that there is a service out there in Gazelle that provides a much easier, much more convenient, much faster, much safer way to get that value for your device is a challenge, a marketing challenge for us.
So when you buy these devices, whom are you selling the used devices to?
I would say it falls into three different categories. The biggest market is in the emerging countries, Southeast Asia. It goes into the Philippines, into Malaysia. The Middle East is a big market, Nigeria. A second category of buyers are insurance companies. When you lose your phone, you drop it in the water. Well, you're not getting a new one. The third would be consumers that don't get the warranty or consumers that want to buy a used laptop, a used iPad for their kids maybe.
They'll go to
eBay. They'll go to Amazon. They'll go to our store on those marketplaces and buy directly from us.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Israel Ganot, the co-founder of Gazelle, a company that resells used electronic equipment. Personal circumstances caused you to move back to Boston in 2006. You, at the time, had been living in the San Francisco area, but your wife wanted to move back to her hometown in Boston. Can you describe that moment?
It was obviously a very important moment in our relationship. And we had an 18-month-old, we had an 8-week-old, two girls. And, you know, both I and my wife, both of us grew up with lots of family around us. And my family was in Israel at the time. And we tried once to fly to Israel from the Bay Area. And it was a complete disaster with the baby crying for 10 straight hours on the flight. And it was time to pack up, move to Boston, and be close to family. and figure out the career stuff later.
Right. You mentioned your family was in Israel. You actually were born in Peru and spent the first 5 or 6 months of your life in Peru. What brought your parents to Peru initially?
So my dad spent 25 years with the Israeli army. He specialized in training of tanks. I guess at the time, in 1970, the Israeli army was in the process of selling tanks to the Peruvian army. I was born there, and they spent about a year there before moving back to Israel.
Were your parents in Israel when the country was founded after World War II?
Both of them were. My dad was born in Bulgaria, so he moved to Israel 3 years before the country was founded. My mom actually was born in Jerusalem under the British mandate.
You spent the first 18 years of your life roughly in Israel. What was the reason for moving to the United States?
Yes, so my parents in the late 80s, it was actually pretty tough times in Israel in terms of a very prolonged recession. Nobody in my family has ever been to college at the time, and they just felt that education and just giving us an opportunity was their life mission. And I guess they said it's now or never, and just got on the plane and moved here with absolutely no prospects for a job.
So you get off the plane, and what next?
What next? So first, you're intimidated by moving to New York. It was really scary, actually, in the early days. My father scrambling to find a job, my mom looking for a job, I was looking for a job, and it was really all about survival.
What were some of the early jobs you got?
It was for a video store. It was 77th Street and Lexington Avenue, okay. Video Vogue, no longer there. And they were selling consumer electronics in the front. I grew up just loving watching movies. So the idea of working at a store, even was at $4 an hour, bringing movies home and watching them for free, was very appealing to me. I started working there and really didn't have a plan for where to take it.
What else about, just in addition to building a work ethic and having to scramble, how else did working in the video store influence
right.
you? I mean, there were electronics in the front of the store. Was there any resonance there?
Well, basically, the purpose of the store was to serve the clientele of the Upper East Side and provide the highest possible customer service known to mankind.
Okay.
So some of the customers were Woody Allen, Robin Williams, Ron Perlman, and they were just very demanding customers. So it was all about doing whatever it takes. But frankly, for me, it was a shock to the system. My first images were not kind of happy memories of watching movies. Was my first winter in New York, delivering movies on my feet while it was snowing and blizzards on the streets, going 10, 20 blocks on Park Avenue, Fifth Avenue, delivering movies to those glamorous apartments, mansions in Manhattan. Just my jaw was dropping every time I was dropping off a movie in some of those places. That was cleaning the toilet, frankly, and cleaning the shelves and making sure the store looked good and that it was welcoming to our customers. Those were their early days at Video Vogue.
So moving from Video Vogue to NYU, where you finally went to college and got a degree, what were your ambitions professionally? Were you just trying to make ends meet, or did you have some longer-term plan?
So living in New York, it was kind of natural to gravitate to the finance world. I don't remember the name of the book, but I remember a book that was written about the life of Ron Perlman. It was coincidentally a weekend day that he stopped by.
Ron Perlman being the
Revlon guy, the corporate raider of the 1980s. Which started to get me thinking about Wall Street. The movie Wall Street obviously came out in 1987. And I feel that's something that I could actually pursue.
What were your parents doing, incidentally? What kind of jobs did they hold?
So my dad was a limo driver, a car service driver. And my mom worked at one of the Israeli newspapers.
After you graduated from NYU, your first job outside of college was at Harvard Business School writing cases for them. And one of the cases you happened to help write was about Microsoft, where you went out to Seattle and you wrote about Bill Gates. Can you describe any interesting tidbits from that experience?
Yeah, that experience clearly planted a seed in me about the future of technology. And one of the things that Bill Gates said at the office, we spent about 3 hours with him. One thing that he said that I'll never forget was that Israel, one of the best ways to change the world is through technology, which has become evident over the years, obviously, with the companies like Microsoft and others. But for me personally, coming from my business background, my finance background, I frankly didn't know who Bill Gates was. I was barely using email at the time, let alone Windows. So that was a whole new world to me. Now, at the time, I didn't know what to do with it. Other than the fact that it was intriguing and interesting, I still had that Wall Street bug in me, so I had to go back and get it out of my system.
So you ultimately went to Goldman Sachs and graduated from HBS and got the Wall Street bug out of you. And then you begin a whole new chapter professionally, which is really in startups and e-commerce. Even though you were an employee at these companies, you still had this entrepreneurial itch because in 1997, actually while you were still at Goldman Sachs, you co-authored a business plan for a startup called Cosmo.com, which at the time was an internet-based video rental business,
right,
which at one point had a $1 billion valuation in 99.
Yes, they actually filed the S-1 in March of 2000, and they were ready to go public.
How did you come to be on the founding team of Cosmo?
So one of my cubemates at Goldman was the co-founder of Cosmo, and he came up with the notion of the idea behind Cosmo right after the Amazon IPO. He approached me because he knew about my experience working at Video Vogue. And we worked together for about 6 months, nights and weekends, developing the business plan, coming up with the name. And at the end of the day, he decided to leave Goldman and pursue it full time and build Cosmo. I decided to go back to business school.
Were there any impressions from that experience that you've carried with you?
That the world was going to change. It was pretty clear that the world was about to change and the internet was going to revolutionize everything.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Israel Ganot, the co-founder of Gazelle, a company that resells used electronic equipment. Prior to starting Gazelle, Israel worked as a research analyst at Goldman Sachs and a finance director at eBay and PayPal. What were some important impressions from eBay or your PayPal experience that have carried over to Gazelle?
What was amazing about that time is to spend 2 years with entrepreneurs in those markets, building their companies from scratch, learning about their challenges of building a business, how they think about an exit strategy, whether eBay was going to buy them, an IPO, a different kind of partnership. So I just soaked up all that knowledge. That was really helpful for me to get a glimpse of what it's like to be an entrepreneur in all those different markets.
I want to go back to the early days of Gazelle for a moment. I want to talk about venture capital. In 2008, even though you had this auspicious moment where the economy was collapsing and people wanted to, you know, resell their items, the economy was collapsing. So, venture capitalists did not have their checkbooks open. What was that experience like for you?
Yeah, first thing I'll say, it was never easy to raise capital in my experience at Gazelle. But the context of when you raise money obviously is critical. And you're raising a good point. So in late 2008, we were raising our second round of capital. So the first round was completed in 2007. Venrock, who incidentally was one of the early investors in Apple, was the lead investor of the Series A. Now, in November of 2008, we were ready to close the B round with Rockport Capital. And I'll never forget the day when we were going to close the deal. That was one of the days that the Dow was fell 1,000 points. And I was really nervous about, is this deal going to close? And I remember at the time, even the Rockport guys, I mean, they still wanted to pursue it, but everybody was getting cold feet. That was the week after the, I don't know if you remember, the Sequoia presentation came out about how the world was going to come to an end and investments were going to shut down and companies had to scale back their growth ambitions. And here we are, pitching a story about growth and about how this is the, you know, the recession and this dynamics in the market was one of the best things that ever happened to Gazelle. So it helped us push the deal through and get it done. But was it easy? Absolutely not.
You co-founded Gazelle with Rousseau Aurelien and James Michelini. Even before you came on board, Rousseau and James were seriously flirting with this concept, and they had borrowed $60,000 to buy used equipment that they then repurposed and sold on eBay for $500,000. Can you elaborate on that?
Yes, so that was fascinating for me when I met with Rousseau, and he was telling me that story in terms of the success they were having. And his point was, everything sells. Everything sells at good profit. The only challenge that we have is getting more equipment. And that was kind of the foundation for the idea for Gazelle and Recommerce. At the time, the whole consumer electronics business on eBay was a $14 billion business. It was just a lot of demand.
So it was Rousseau who had the initial idea for this Recommerce recycling business.
Yeah, what I love the most about Rousseau is such an amazing guy. He's the true visionary guy. I'm more the guy with 2 feet on the ground, getting stuff done. He was really the visionary guy. What really sold me on joining him and, James was his grand vision. And his grand vision was to introduce the concept of trade-ins into other consumer categories, starting with electronics, but also sporting goods, golf clubs, fashion items, IT equipment, servers, etc. So the vision was big. Now, pretty quickly after joining the team and we started actually thinking about developing a plan, we had to start somewhere in a narrow focus.
Now, Rousseau is from Haiti.
Yes. And we kind of went together through the earthquake in Haiti, where his parents' house was completely demolished by the earthquake, and they moved to the U.S. and kind of seeing him going through that period, you know, tough period in his life, his family's life, was interesting and, you know, something I could definitely empathize with.
Simultaneously, while Rousseau and James were pursuing this concept on the East Coast, while you were still back West, you wanted to recycle your own mobile equipment. What was that story?
The story was before I moved back here, before I knew about Rousseau, I went down to a retail store and tried to recycle a couple of BlackBerry phones. And I go in and I ask the guy how much for these phones, and the guy goes, $20. Said, $20, I can sell them on eBay for $75. And he goes, no, actually, we're going to charge you $20 for the privilege of recycling. And that was when I had this big aha moment. The consumers are not going to pay for the privilege of recycling. And that's how, the idea of Recommerce kind of started to germinate in my head.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me on the show.
My guest has been Israel Ganot, the co-founder of Gazelle. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.